Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark. I'm joined by two of our regulars, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center and Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal. Damon Linker is off this week, and sitting in for him is the Bulwark publisher, Sarah Longwell. And we are delighted to welcome as our special guest this week, Brink Lindsay, also of the Niskanen Center and not always on this continent. So welcome back to North America, Brink. All right. Let us begin with the war between Gaza, between Hamas and Israel, and the dissension within the Democratic Party about how to handle this. Hamas has, depending on how you count it and what time it is, fired some 4,000 rockets into Israeli cities and towns. Israel has responded with airstrikes. There's a humanitarian disaster unfolding in Hamas, in Gaza, rather. There are 200 dead Palestinians, 12 dead Israelis. So let me start with you, Linda. We've been through these before. Does anything strike you as different this time?
Yes. Unfortunately, I think Joe Biden is leaning a little bit into his progressive caucus, and he at least gives every indication of starting to take a harder line with Israel. Obviously, all of us would like to see the fighting stop, but I think it's important to remember that it was Hamas that launched those 4,000 rockets into Israeli cities, and that Israel has not only a right to defend itself, but has a right to try to protect itself from future attacks, which is why it is using overwhelming force to try to disrupt the network of tunnels that lead from Gaza into Israel that have been the source of, tremendous attacks on Israel in the past. And I think that so long as you see some wavering in support in Congress on the Democratic side, putting Israel in a very difficult position. I don't think that I'm not a huge fan of Bibi Netanyahu in a lot of circumstances, but I don't think he really has a choice here in terms of trying to deal a really overwhelming blow against Hamas, because it's not just these attacks on Israel. It's also Hamas is trying to get political control over the Palestinian people. It is trying to wrest whatever support the Palestinian Authority has and the various other groups. It wants preeminence, and of course, it's being aided in addition by Iran. So I think we're in a very tough situation right now. And obviously, it would be great to have a ceasefire, but I don't think Israel is ready to have a real ceasefire until they feel like their military goals are met.
Bill, the trend in the Democratic and Republican parties has been evident for at least 15 years now, namely increasing support for Israel among Republicans, decreasing support among Democrats. The Trump years turbocharged those trends. So you saw, for example, that between 2016 and 2018, support for Israel among Democrats really plummeted, and only 27% of Democrats in 2018 said that they were more sympathetic toward Israel than they were toward the Palestinians, whereas 79% of Republicans say that they are. Do you see, so, you know, we've heard from Rashida Tlaib, who is an Arab American member of Congress, who's saying that Israel practices apartheid. And AOC has voiced similar sentiments. Do you see a tendency in the left of the Democratic Party to see Israel through a domestic social justice or racial justice lens?
Well, yes, and this this is nothing new. I would caution, however, against explaining too much of what's going on with reference to the internal politics of the Democratic Party or the internal politics of the United States, for that matter. I think the conflict in the Middle East right now is being very much driven by its own imperatives. And there are people on both sides who have an interest in continuing the military dimensions of this struggle. And I wish that the spectrum of discussion in the United States were as broad and nuanced as it is in Israel, because the standard analysis in Israel is that there are two winners of the conflict already, namely Netanyahu and Hamas, and two losers, namely President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, who's now in the 16th year of his four-year elected term, and the anti-Netanyahu coalition in Israel, which was about to declare the successful formation of a coalition government to oust Netanyahu. I also wish that it were possible to decouple the question of the military struggle between Hamas and Israel from the broader question of the events leading up to this particular explosion of violence. I despair of being able to conduct a nuanced discussion of any of these questions, under the pressure of American political imperatives.
So, Brink, Bill mentioned that Netanyahu who is quite the political maneuverer and survivor, was unable to form a government. Israel's had four elections in a very short period of time, I think over just a couple of years. He was not able to form a government this time, and he was about to have to hand it over, as Bill says, to the opposition, and then Hamas hands him a huge favor. And so now his popularity is rising again. There is that. But one of the proposals that I saw in terms of going forward, look, there will be a ceasefire. These things are always, they always come to an end. And then things go back to the way they were. You know, the international community gives support to Hamas to rebuild, which is necessary because they have terrible devastation. But then they use some of that to stockpile more missiles, getting ready for the next round of violence. So one of the proposals that I saw, it was from Eli Lake, give Palestinians in Gaza reconstruction aid, but don't funnel it through Hamas this time. What do you think? Possible?
So I think there are better and worse ideas of how the U.S. can respond to these things at the margins. But I agree with the thrust of Bill's comment that we have very limited leverage over the situation. If I could just sigh continuously for 2 or 3 minutes, that I think would probably be my most eloquent contribution to this discussion. Mm. This is a quagmire that makes your typical quagmire look like a class 5 rapid. Sure. I long for the possibility of a two-state solution. I think the occupation is bad for the Palestinians and it's bad for Israel. But alas, Palestinians have made no moves whatsoever towards a kind of leadership that would make a two-state solution possible. The left has collapsed in Israel, so there's absolutely no political constituency for within Israel for anything other than hardlinism. So I don't see the possibility of things moving in a good direction anytime soon. Meanwhile, I think the U.S. leverage over this is close to nil. Israel can has shown they can brazen it out and live with a lot of international disapproval. And meanwhile, their long-term strategic position seems to be stronger now than it was a decade or two ago. However this turns out one way or another, the larger implications for the world are pretty small. This just isn't a Cold War frontline battlefield anymore. The importance of oil lurking in the background isn't the same as it used to be. The common enemy of Israel, of Iran, has brought Arab states into making peace with Israel. So the dynamics have all changed. I can see this messy, bad equilibrium being stable for quite some time. And so my most realistic hope is that the Biden administration doesn't get dragged into making claims for things it can accomplish that are not capable of being accomplished.
Yeah, that's those are really good points. And apparently the Biden administration had hoped to back burner this matter, though obviously they can't control what happens on the ground. But they certainly weren't charging into office, with huge promises of breakthroughs in the region. They seemed to me a lot more realistic about that. But Sarah, I want to pick up a little bit on Brink's point about the importance of this region, because I do think it's really interesting the selectivity of world attention and our own press's attention to conflicts around the world. So just a quick survey. There have been 2,000 people killed in the last year in Ethiopia's Tigray province. We haven't heard a word about it, or very little. There have been 10,000 people, overwhelming majority civilians, killed in the fighting in eastern Ukraine over the last few years. There have been 11,000 civilians killed in Africa by Boko Haram. In Syria, there have been 400,000 killed. Now, this, of course, did get attention, but again, not the kind of minute, casualty by casualty, blow by blow coverage that you get with Israel and Palestinians. So 400,000 killed in Syria, 5.6 million refugees, and on Yemen, I mean, same story. So it is striking, isn't it, that this conflict, and it is, this is not to say the conflict isn't terrible, and for the people involved, it is awful, but we do pay way disproportionate attention, don't we?
Yeah, although I don't know. I guess it sort of makes sense to me that we do, in part because just about every American president in my lifetime has kind of made it, they're going to be the ones to help solve this problem. And so we've become deeply invested in trying to solve the problem. And also, I think that we're closer culturally in a lot of ways. I mean, I know lots of people who've been to Israel. I've consumed lots of media that talks about Israel and Palestine and this conflict in a way that I do not consume media that talks about lots of these other conflicts. I will say, I don't understand why we have to talk about this, because I was pretty sure that Donald Trump and Jared had solved this problem. And so I was deeply certain that this had already been solved for us. And joking aside, I guess I understand Linda's criticism of Joe Biden and the way that he's handling this. But I guess there's also this part of me that is relieved that Joe Biden is the one in this position as opposed to either Donald Trump or a different Democrat. Because at least he has this decades-long relationship with Netanyahu, and has a long-term sense of America's engagement with the conflict, and whether or not he is being pulled by his left flank, which I think is undoubtedly true. The politics around Israel have completely changed on the left, and he's got a ton of different pressures than previous presidents. But I am glad that it's him as opposed to potentially somebody else.
Yes. Bernie, yeah. I did learn something today listening to the New York Times daily podcast, which I had suspected but hadn't heard confirmed before. But they seem to say that, you know, Biden was really not 100%, very much not on board with Obama's approach to Israel, felt that the Obama administration didn't take Israel's concerns into account nearly often enough. But that much having been said, I think, Sarah, I'll ask this of you. It seems to me that one of the things that Israel always had going for it vis-a-vis the United States was that support for Israel was a bipartisan matter. And Netanyahu really strongly, first of all, he went hard against Obama and he, lashed himself to Trump. And that tended to polarize added to the polarization in the United States is in the Americans' views about Israel. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I agree, and I can really agree with it mainly from my own perspective, which is I was 20 years ago, young conservative, just reflexively very pro-Israel, and it was kind of just an easy, comfortable position for me to have. Everyone that I knew was pro-Israel. And I would say that in the last 5 years, I've really recalibrated. Sort of grown up political observer, I've just watched it more. And there's something about, I don't know if other people feel this, there's something for me about having gotten older and having kids that causes me to look at these issues slightly with a more I heard the Daily where they talked to a 22-year-old Palestinian woman, it breaks your heart listening to people talk about what it's like to live with your five siblings, who are one of whom is 4 years old, and your parents, and how you all, live through the shelling and the bombing, and it's just it's very humanized, and what's going on is tragic and heartbreaking, and you do sort of wish that there could be, be a way that these groups could find that it wasn't just living in sort of perpetual violence. But Trump and his relationship with Netanyahu caused me to feel very differently about Netanyahu, as well as the fact that under Netanyahu, Israel has pushed further right and sort of pushed the boundaries of what they're doing in ways that make me less comfortable.
Yep. Okay, Bill Galston, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I just wanted, from within the Jewish community, I can tell you that the 12 Netanyahu years have been a disaster for the relationship between the Democratic Party and Israel. Because people who are strongly pro-Israel are not strongly pro Netanyahu, and many are firmly opposed to him, and that has created cross pressures that has muted a lot of voices, including, I will admit, mine. My breaking point came when Netanyahu, without clearing it with the White House or the Democratic leadership in Congress, accepted the invitation of Republican congressional leaders to address a joint session of Congress denouncing the policies of the sitting president of the United States. Netanyahu could not have chosen a better way to drive a wedge between Israel and the United States than that speech provided.
Okay. Since we've sounded that note, I will just say for the record, because I don't disagree with that, but I feel the need to add a little bit of a note of support for the pro-Israel side of this argument by pointing out that some of the things that are being said on the left are really over the top. Calling Israel an apartheid state is one of them. Israeli Arabs, of course, are full citizens. They vote. They have members in the Knesset. There are Arab Israelis who sit on the Supreme Court. They have a certain special status. Christians and Muslims are not required to serve in the IDF, though many do volunteer, or some volunteer. But in any event, it is it has been said that Israeli Arabs enjoy more rights than Arabs anywhere else on planet Earth. So that's just worth saying for the record without commenting on Mr. Netanyahu. Okay, let us move on to the vote that happened yesterday regarding a January 6th commission. Sarah, you were optimistic. You thought there were going to be more than a dozen Republicans who would vote for it. There were. How are you feeling about this?
It is so rare that my optimism comes to fruition. Usually I'm just like Charlie Brown with the football. But I did think that, the last couple of weeks where there are, of course, it is a small number of Republicans, but this idea of purging Liz Cheney has left a bitter taste in a bunch of Congress people's mouths. And I think many of them are frustrated with Kevin McCarthy and with the switch in leadership and being told to take a voice vote, which was a very cowardly way to purge Cheney. And so I think some of it, I believed that there was going to be a dynamic of dissatisfaction from a decently high number. On the other Bulwark podcast, the next level, JVL had kind of set the line at 28. And he and Tim, my colleagues, took the under on that. I took the over, and I was actually not sure that I wouldn't come away from that, chagrined once again and disappointed. But 35 or 34, I guess, ultimately, if you look back at the first impeachment, you got 0 Republicans in the House. The second, you got 10. And now for the commission, you got 34. So as far as if I'm going to try my best to be optimistic and look for a silver lining, that's at least trending in the right direction. But my optimism flags when I see the reports coming out of the Senate. I think that McCarthy is very concerned about what a commission is going to turn up about his members. And I think he has gone to McConnell and McConnell has conveyed it to other senators that there is no good that comes of this for them, that it will be politically bad for them in the midterms, that there's all kinds of, things that might come out. And so I think that the Senate may very well shut it down. In fact, I thought when I was doing my own whip count that at least you'd get the 7 senators who voted to impeach. But looking today, right now, even Susan Collins is not saying that she's going to be for
and
it.
And Richard Burr.
And Burr and some of the other people that would normally be on the list. And so it's disappointing. I don't think it's completely dead yet, but I do think it's looking less likely.
Brink Lindsey worth breaking the filibuster to create this commission? Because they're not going to get 60. Well, it looks like it'd be tough to get 60, 10 Republican votes, therefore 60 votes.
I'm not a big fan of the filibuster and it's the way it's been used in the past recent years. So I wouldn't mind seeing it go, but I don't think it's going to go for this. And I'm not sure the stakes really are high enough to warrant going nuclear in that respect for this vote. I think there ought to be a commission. Of course, it's just lamentable and deplorable that we're excited that 34 Republicans in the House voted the right way. It looks like Senate Republicans will kill it. I'm done playing football with Lucy. So we already know that this is Trump's party, that the base fully believes in the big lie and insists on its electeds humoring them. And that the electeds are going beyond that to make sure that the minoritarian power grab that failed this time will be successful next time. So the Republican Party is dead rotten. Its base is in the throes of terrible anti-democratic illiberal delusions. And I think we should have a commission because it's the right thing to do. But I see very little potential that that disclosures from this commission are going to produce some kind of road to Damascus conversion on the part of any significant chunk of the Republican electorate. I don't see them being persuaded. The only thing to do now is to beat them. It's just to beat them again and again and again, and for the Democrats to have the self-discipline to stay popular enough to keep beating them. So the commission should happen, but even if it did, I don't think it's a game changer.
So, Bill, two things are going on. Well, a number of things are going on. But so the Republican line about this is we can't look back. We have to only look forward. We don't want to be backward looking. And the January 6th was no big deal. So they say that on the one hand. And on the other hand, they say, but we have to compare it to if we're going to study that, then we should have a commission to look into the violence in Portland over the summer and that sort of thing, which they do think was a big deal, but they're comparing them. But in any case, this is part of a larger picture. They are denying the reality of what happened on January 6th and inventing this lie and circulating the lie about the vote being stolen. So this week we heard from the Republican Majority Board of Supervisors in Maricopa County. So let's hear from one of their spokespeople. Let's hear what he said.
Maricopa County, we don't do what's easy. We do what's right. We've done that for the last 6 months. Four out of the five members of the Board of Supervisors are Republicans. We recognize, and I anticipate you're going to ask questions about this, that a large percentage of Republicans believe that the election was stolen in 2020, and that, you know, Donald Trump actually won. I want to be clear that I believe that Joe Biden won the election. All right. And the reason that I feel confident in saying that, particularly in Maricopa County, is that we overturned every stone. And we have professionals, both with the early voting and the election day voting. They did everything right. We asked the difficult questions. All right. And we certified the election back in November. But now it's time to say enough is enough. It is time to push back on the big lie. We must do this. We must do this as a member of the Republican Party. We must do this as a member of the Board of Supervisors. We need to do this as a country. Otherwise, we are not going to be able to move forward and have an election in 2022 that we can all believe the results, whatever they may be.
So, Bill, it does seem to me that if as we keep seeing, all of these local Republican auditors and others are now popping up to say they're going to challenge and re-audit and recount again and search for bamboo shreds and ballots and so forth, that the stakes really could not be higher because the Republicans are telegraphing that they don't believe elections are legitimate anymore if they don't go their way.
Well, I wish I could say that this was something new. But in fact, that's exactly what Donald Trump was asked a week or so before the election of 2016, if you'll recall.
I do.
And so you have a combination of a demagogue and a bunch of people eager to be demagogued coming together to produce a genuine threat to the continuation of constitutional democracy in the United States. I have nothing to add to the eloquent statement that you just heard from a member of the board in Maricopa County. He spoke the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And the only question now is, what are the options available to people like us who want democracy that enjoys the trust of the American people to be perpetuated for our children and grandchildren? I wish I had some glib answer to that question. Like a lot of people, I'll bet, who are listening to this, I'm engaged in a lot of discussions, a lot of cooperative activities with people who are doing their level best to figure out what to do and then to do it with all of the energy and determination they have. I study these things for a living, and I am at a loss as to what to do if an overwhelming majority of one of the two major political parties in the United States is determined to insist on its own view of reality. And so, like Brink, in response to the first question, I wish I could just moan for 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, I really, I don't often say this, but I am, I haven't given up hope, but I am at my wit's end as to what people who believe the truth about the 2020 election can say to people who don't. If anybody else, you know, has a more hopeful response, I hope to hear it in the next couple of minutes.
Well, Linda, I'm turning to you for the hope here. I think the significance of this commission is nothing that the commission will find. I mean, the commission could find beyond a shadow of a doubt that Trump orchestrated the whole thing, that Lauren Boebert was carrying an M16, and guiding people. They could find any number of things, and we know how the Republican base would take that. They would say it's all fiction. So I don't think that what the commission would find is so significant. I think that what's significant is that 83% of the Republican members of Congress, of the House, voted against even forming a commission, which tells you where they are.
It does. And I can't sound an optimistic note here about any hope of getting a congressional commission put together that is going to do an autopsy of what happened on January 6th. I don't think that's going to happen. I think any report that was done, no matter how meticulous, no matter how careful, no matter how fair, would in fact be interpreted by the various parties in totally different ways. But let me throw something out here, and I don't know that this is possible either, and it may be off the wall. But, you know, I look back, being old has some advantages, and having lived through history, I was around during the riots in the 1960s. And I look back on the Kerner Commission report. And that, of course, was a commission that was not put together by Congress. It was established by Lyndon Johnson, and it was to study the cause of urban rioting in the 1960s. We have something very different taking place today, but something that is very much tearing apart the nation and polarizing the nation. And that is the radicalization that's taking place on the right, the disaffection from truth, the way in which the right has been galvanized into a kind of, cult group that follows Donald Trump, whatever path he wants to lead them down. But we also have radicalization taking place on the left. And I don't dismiss that the riots in Portland and other cities were horrendous and were very harmful. And if you happen to live in those communities, they did great damage. So I don't know if the president, President Biden, could do this or would want to do this, but forming a commission of absolutely stellar individuals that were not identified as partisans in any way, intellectuals and others, that do cut across the space to look at trying to understand what is happening in the polarization and radicalization that is taking place in America today, I think would be useful. Now, it wouldn't, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, giving in to the people on the right who say, let's have a commission, but let's study Antifa too. That's not really what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to make a kind of moral equivalency here, because I think the attack on the Capitol, because it was literally an attack on democratic institutions, was fundamentally different than the kinds of attacks that took place in cities where police stations were burned, etc. But I am more interested in the underlying phenomena of what is happening to the American people, where you now have large portions of certainly the Republican Party and the Republican base who have become radicalized. And I think you have a growing radical movement on the left as well. And trying to get a better understanding of that, somebody needs to take a look at this in a careful way, in a way that is not simply aimed at coming up with, you know, good talking points for the various political parties in their agendas. And I don't know if Biden is willing to do something like that, or if it's even possible to do. But I, for one, would like to see some serious study of the phenomena that's taking place.
Well, thank you for that. And it actually segues perfectly into our third topic today, which is Brink's excellent article that appeared on the Niskanen site called Moderation in Pursuit of Social Justice is an Indispensable Virtue. So this, Brink, was a play on the old Goldwater line, which...
moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Right. And what was the second half of it?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue.
There you go. Okay. So you've modified this quite a bit. And,
yeah. I turned it on its head. Yes.
You did. So let's talk about this because you're arguing for the importance of putting aside one's vanity and trying to score points and saying, look, you know, let's try to do things that actually work. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Tell us your thesis.
Yeah, well, here again, we have an issue, a thorny, vexed issue that, you know, dates all the way back to before the formation of our republic as a blight on America, the issue of slavery and mistreatment of African Americans post-slavery, and right now we've got a very polarized debate. On the one hand, the vast majority of Republicans now think whites are more discriminated against than blacks, and just view any sympathy for the goals of the Black Lives Matter protests as sort of sympathy with anti-American radicalism. On the other hand, you have far left social justice activism that has cowed more centrist liberals into sort of going along with what the most extreme people on the left saying for fear of being stigmatized as you know, part of the white supremacy problem. Polarization thrives on false dilemmas. This is a false dilemma. There's a big fat center ground, which is correct, which is that the legacy of 2.5 centuries of slavery and a century of Jim Crow is still with us. That there are just by inertia and by policies that were built during the openly racist era remaining in place. You have African Americans in many ways subject to structural disadvantages that keep them down and that inhibit their mobility and integration into the mainstream of American society. So that's that phenomenon, that inertia of structural Black disadvantage is what the social justice activists call systemic racism. So I think the phenomenon is real. But I think the name and the framing are terribly unfortunate and self-indulgent and counterproductive. So we've had a great cultural victory in recent decades of completely stigmatizing and marginalizing open bigotry and intolerance, which used to just be endemic in mm-hmm. American life. But then once having accomplished that, then we take the terms for bigotry and intolerance, racism, white supremacy, and redefine them so that they now apply to American society as a whole. I think that rhetorical switcheroo is just doomed to be inflaming and produce defensive reactions on the part of many white folks. And yet it allows the people who deploy that rhetoric the thrill of righteous indignation and standing on top of the moral high ground and denouncing everything as of a piece with racism. Then meanwhile, you have this kind of rhetorical whipsaw that the truth behind the systemic racism analysis is that you don't need bigotry and intolerance to sustain Black disadvantage. Inertia will do it for you.
I think that's a key point. Can I just get a Sharpie and underline that? Because that gets missed all the time, that the legacy of slavery and discrimination is enough to account for the differences that we see in life outcomes between American Blacks and American whites without saying that there is a continuing racist or white supremacist structure pressing down on them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there still is racism and discrimination in American life. I think there's pretty well documented ongoing discrimination in housing and job markets, but it pales in comparison to the weight of the past in accounting for the current disparities between Black and white standards of living. But we have this truth that inertia is enough, but then they try to market that truth by using the terms for bigotry and intolerance to describe it, which is perverse. And then at the very same time that we're supposed to be focusing on structures, we've had this sort of explosion of a kind of tent revival atmosphere across the country of seeking out and rooting out individual acts of bigotry and intolerance and condemning them and putting pressure on whites in everywhere from K-12 classrooms to diversity and inclusion trainings in corporate America for whites to sort of confess their sins and confess their individual blameworthiness. So you have, I think, this sort of deep incoherence in the kind of state of anti-racism today, where you've got this, I think, correct push to look at the structures that are maintaining inequitable disparities in American life. But you're doing it in a way that's just seems calculated to make people push back against it. And then at the same time, you have this huge sort of explosion of focus on looking into people's individual hearts and minds and passing judgment on them.
And your point is that it isn't really worthwhile to sort of try to police what people think and feel, as much as it is good to focus on policies that are going to improve the lives of everyone, including Black people.
Yeah. So when it comes to the sort of relationship between culture and structure, when it comes to poverty, progressives are quite clear that they hate discussions of culture of poverty and think they put the cart before the horse. That a lot of what we look at is the culture of poverty of family breakdown and high crime rates and drug use and low attachment to the job market, they say are largely consequences of these structures and of these disparities. And if you improved Black lives, then the culture would take care of itself. But then when it comes to anti-racism activism, there's this incredible focus on hearts and minds and purifying, getting whites to face up to the deep ugliness that's in their hearts. So, those don't go together.
Okay. Really, really interesting piece. Who wants to jump in? Linda?
Yeah, I would like to jump in. First of all, it was a very interesting piece, and I thought you dealt with a very difficult situation, a very difficult topic, rather, in a very nuanced way. One of the things that I think was most important about your piece, and I think that it is something that conservatives in particular fail to recognize, is the role that housing discrimination and the continued prevalence of not segregation, legal segregation in the housing market, but nonetheless, the way in which communities still are divided in many parts of the country by race is very important, because housing, where you live, determines where you go to school by and large, particularly if you're not a person of means and cannot afford private school for your children. It obviously affects your sense of safety. If you live in a high crime neighborhood, you're going to have a very different experience than if you live in a safe neighborhood. It affects your accumulation of wealth. Most Americans, the primary source of their wealth is their home ownership and the equity that they're able to put together in that home ownership. So I thought that was very interesting and important. But I also thought that, your emphasis on talking about the way in which discussions of systemic racism, the discussion of, the efforts to make all whites feel that they are somehow privileged by their skin color, I think this is something the left just doesn't understand. Is not only, I think it's wrong, number one, but it is so enormously counterproductive. The number of people who are willing to self-flagellate and to, take on themselves individual responsibility for the history of legacy of slavery, for example, I think is small. And it is particularly small in communities made up of people whose ancestors weren't even here, much less, were part of, the slave-owning population in the 19th century and prior. So I thought that was, I thought it was a terrific piece, and the part about the role that housing plays, I thought was particularly insightful.
Yeah, I didn't put this in the piece, but certainly shaping the way I was thinking about this is my own experience in an ideological movement, in the libertarian movement, and where I was never really on the radical fringe, but that radical fringe always vexed me. And it vexed me that there were a whole host of ideas that the libertarian movement was putting forward that had mainstream appeal, and yet people the sort of the radicals insisted on framing them in this deeply unpopular critique of sort of government, any government at all, a kind of anarchistic critique of that all government is illegitimate. There's a thrill of radical critique. There's a thrill of being lonely at the top of an unassailable moral high ground. And for libertarians, it's being able to proclaim everybody else is a statist, and you're the only person who really takes human freedom seriously. And it's exciting to, to win the ideological purity contest, and be the biggest L libertarian in your group. But that doesn't change the world. It's just purely performative self-indulgence. And I'm afraid a lot of that is going on the social justice left too. On the housing issue, just in the last 5 or 10 years, we've had this huge sea change where finally, there is a broader recognition of the perversities of the way we regulate land use. And it's has terrible outcomes on a whole host of fronts. It makes housing unaffordable all over the place. It stymies economic growth by preventing our most dynamic regions from growing. It worsens climate change by encouraging sprawl, and it locks in residential segregation and prevents the kind of mobility that would allow a closing of black-white gaps. So right now, when there is a chance for a really broad-based coalition to push what I think is probably the single most important policy lever to help improve Black lives on the ground, there's a yearning to divert that issue into making it all about racial justice, which will narrow the constituency for change and therefore doom efforts to. I don't think you should ignore race. I think that's one argument to throw into the mix. But the idea should be to build the broadest possible coalitions for changes that will actually help people on the ground rather than to score ideological points. And I'm afraid the latter is more important to ideologues.
Bill Galston, do you agree with Brink that it's the best public policy lever that we have available, changing our housing policies?
It's certainly one of them. And it's one of the prime examples of pretty much overt policies leading, you know, preparing the ground for the kinds of residential patterns that we have now. And I'm not focusing so much on current zoning practices as I am on the policies of the FHA after the Second World War, which largely created, magnified problems of residential segregation because African Americans were largely dealt out of the huge surge in home ownership and wealth creation that occurred after the Second World War with the active assistance of government and particularly the FHA. So I think that's, you know, that is a case where it's not simply inertia that produced current patterns that are unacceptable. It was active government policy. And if I could name one area where a measure of explicit reparation might make sense, it would probably be housing. Having said that, I think we have to pay attention to the problem as it's presenting itself right now, which is a problem not just of economic opportunity, but of policing and the rule of law. I think it's a very good example of the wisdom of the general approach that Brink is recommending. Because conservatives say defend the police and progressives say defund the police, neither is the answer. Each exacerbates the problem. There are significant problems that need to be dealt with boldly but practically. And I am hopeful that the current negotiations led on the Senate side by Tim Scott and on the on the House side by Karen Bass, with a lot of senators and representatives who are in the disappearing but not yet vanished center participating behind the scenes. There's an example where we have a chance of getting past the rhetoric and actually doing something that will make people's lives better.
Sarah, I had occasion to be discussing this not too long ago with somebody who identifies as a leftist. And I, you know, mentioned that, you know, if you talk to people in the African-American community, in the Hispanic community, they are not for defunding the police. They want policing. Their neighborhoods are not safe. And in some cases. And so, you know, it's really a case where people on the left, in this instance, I would argue, and tell me what you think, they mistake their preference for what's best for minority communities, and those are not always the same thing.
Yeah, and it's like this on so many subjects, and the thing that really that I loved about Brink's piece is this conversation around the collapse of the center, but also this passage, you know, I think there's value in setting forth reasons why strong disagreement with one pole of the debate doesn't mean you have to wind up at the other pole. Polarization on racial issues as well as more generally thrives on false dilemmas. I mean, I think about this in terms of just, you can think about it in so many issues, like the issue of immigration. It is not a conversation about open borders and building a wall. Like, that is not where the vast majority of Americans live and exist in the way that they're thinking about politics. They are much more moderate. And I think that, you know, there are opportunities for us to figure out how to rebuild that center. And I was interested actually in whether Brink had any thoughts on that, because I think it's something I think about a lot, knowing that most of the loudest voices on either side do not represent the bulk of where people are. How do we get our politics to be more reflective of where people are?
Just I'll take this occasion to make a quick Niskanen Center plug. We've just launched a new project on criminal justice reform headed by Greg Newbern, who formerly was the head of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. We are very much trying to look past this false dilemma of uncritically defend the police or defund them. That we see, you know, our goal is less crime and less punishment. That we can't simply focus on mass incarceration as a civil libertarian issue, especially when murder rates are spiking, without paying attention to what happens on the crime control side. So. We think there is a strong body of evidence that what we do now is we don't catch many criminals, and when we do, we give them draconian sentences. What we need to do is move to a different system where we're a lot better at catching criminals, and we give them shorter, more moderate, more certain sentences. So quicker, more certain, less draconian punishment is more effective punishment.
That sounds good.
So there is a better equilibrium out there where we have less crime and we can also start to dismantle the mass incarceration that we built up over recent decades. And that's where we're trying to go.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Brink, for writing this really thoughtful and insightful piece and for sharing your thoughts with us. We'll now turn to our final segment, which is our highlight and lowlight of the or lowlight of the week. Or you could do both if you wanted. Bill Galston, we will start with you this week.
Well, thank you, Mona. My highlight, and it really is a highlight, will take us back to our first topic, you know, the travails of the Middle East. I have long been associated with a research center in Jerusalem called the Hartman Institute. And in the midst of this war, its leader, Daniil Hartman, son of the founder, David Hartman, I think has really distinguished himself as a moral and political voice in the discussion inside Israel and within the Jewish community. He has written a series of very nuanced pieces from his position as a lifelong and unrepentant Zionist, the latest of which is called Why Israel Lost the War. He's not talking about the 1973 war. He's talking about the current one. You can find it by going on the Hartman Institute website, and I commend it to everybody's attention.
Okay, thank you. Sarah Longwell.
Well, I'll go back to our second topic as a highlight. You know, there's a little-known congressman, or I don't know how well-known he is, but John Katko has been a sort of moderate, pragmatic Republican who's in a purple district. And he's the guy who negotiated the terms of the commission. And if anybody has the chance, they should go watch him, the speech that he gave when he was talking about why the commission needed to be formed. One of the things he does in it is systematically dismantle so many of the bad faith reasons that Republicans are putting forward about why the commission shouldn't happen. There's a lot of them who are telling lies about, you know, oh, well, this is how it would just give Democrats control, partisan control of the investigation. And, you know, in this environment where you're basically being purged from the Republican Party, and Kevin McCarthy actually went out of his way to throw Katko under the bus after sending him to negotiate for this commission, I just think Katko has and he's also one of the 10 who voted for impeachment. And he has just been sort of a relentless voice for sanity in the Republican Party, and sort of stood up, I think, in this moment in a way where, I often say, maybe trying to will it to be true, that courage can be contagious. Cowardice is too. And I think, you know, cowardice has been running like a virus through the Republican Party. But to when I see somebody display that kind of courage, and then obviously to get 34 members of the Republican Party, which of course no one should throw a pizza party about. It's still 170 of them voted against it. But it was something, and I appreciated what he did.
Thank you for that. I cannot help adding, since we were discussing the polarization of Democrats and Republicans on the subject of the police, I can't help noting that Republicans are very pro-police, except on January 6th. All right. Let us turn now to Brink Lindsey.
I'm going to plug a book that came out this month on what I consider to be the number one public policy issue on planet Earth right now, the pandemic. In America, we're all getting vaccinated and the light, we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. But I'm afraid that, the coronavirus is going to kill more people in 2021, than it did in 2020, around the world. And very well possibly into the next year as well. Meanwhile, this isn't the last pandemic we're going to face. So we really, really, really need to understand what went wrong and how we can do better, going forward and next time. And one of the most riveting and maddening things I've read about the pandemic is this book that came out this month by Michael Lewis called The Premonition. One of the blurbs on the back is, I would read an 800-page history of the stapler if Michael Lewis wrote it. And that is exactly right. He writes brilliantly. But the thrust of the story is that is all about the failure of America's pandemic response, and in which Trump plays virtually no role in the narrative. The rot, the institutional dysfunctions go way back deeper than that. And he tells the story of the or creation of the of America's first pandemic response policy under the George W. Bush administration, and then how lots of that got used in East Asia, but not in America, and why that happened. And his bad guy is the CDC and to a lesser extent the FDA. But you can see institutional dysfunction and sort of a lack of critically needed state capacity is a longstanding problem that predated Trump. So we've got we've got big work to do to up our game going forward. And he offers a wonderful guide to what went wrong and how to do better.
Thank you. I will look forward to looking at that. I'm a Michael Lewis fan, and also have, over the course of the past year, not been impressed with the CDC. So I'm primed for this book. Linda Chavez.
Well, I have taken a lot of heat for having supported President Biden's nomination to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Kristen Clark, from some of my conservative allies. So I'm going to do an about face on a different civil rights nominee and point to what I consider a low light from the Biden administration. And that is the announcement that President Biden intends to nominate Catherine Lauman, or layman, for the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the Department of Education. I think this is a bad decision and sends all the wrong signals. She was previously in that same position in the Obama administration, and she was the responsible for issuing guidance to universities on enforcing Title IX, specifically in the treatment of sexual assault and harassment in colleges. So, as we know, the Biden administration is probably going to pull back the regulations, which were, I thought, pretty good. that the Trump administration issued under Betsy DeVos that, in fact, did give more due process to those individuals charged with sexual assault or harassment in colleges. And so this appointment, I think, is sending all the wrong signals, and I'm very disappointed.
Couldn't agree more. Not that we're for college sexual assault,
no.
Mind you.
No,
but no, really, that guidance was terrible, and it really sacrificed due process. And yeah, I'm with you, Linda. All right, mine. I'm going to take a page out of the Damon Linker book and recommend somebody on Substack, namely Noah Smith, whose Substack has the cute title of No Opinion. He writes a lot about economics, and one of his posts this week that I'm recommending was called When to Start Worrying About Inflation. And he gives a really very smart and learned sort of quick lesson about inflation and about what causes it and about who's responsible for keeping it in check. And I recommend it, but just to give you a little pricey, he says if inflation stays above 2% for 6 months, you should begin to worry. And he also says when politicians begin to talk about price controls, look out. That's always a bad sign. Okay. Thanks to Brink Lindsay for being our guest this week. Thanks to Sarah Longwell for sitting in. Thanks to our listeners. And we will be back next week as every week.